Well, hey, everybody, and welcome. This is Dave Krueger. I'm really excited about our collaboration. Thank you first for so many of you already sending in responses to the two questions of what would you most like to focus on and where would you like to get to at the end of this. Notice that those are the first two questions. Those of you who've trained at CTA with the simple coaching model, those are the first two questions you ask a client in sequence if you want to get certified. So it's also a way to begin a seminar series, and I really appreciate the responses some of you have sent in that give me an idea. Let me ask, there are a large number of people on the call. Let me ask for a management of the background noise, even if you're not actively saying anything, if you're just moving around, or even, in fact, if you're breathing, would you please put your phone on mute, *6. *6, mute, or on your device if you're on a different device. Thank you. And remember to unmute again if you want to ask a question. I want to reserve some time at the beginning and the end for a discussion. I'm really interested in what your thoughts are, clarifications, and especially the responses to those questions help guide my discussion. I go from the same outline that you do and just kind of weave some things around that I hope will be useful to you, and it's informed in part by some of the things you're most curious about. The link that you received, the link has the four ports for the recordings. I'll be sure that they're up. It also has a download of the workbook and of the outline. I would suggest printing the outline to follow along and track, and the outline and the workbook correspond. They're paired. I'd suggest that you go through the workbook and at least do some of the exercises and work tools that appeal to you to see if you find them helpful to really crystallize or illuminate some aspects of your own wellness story, because I think that's one of the things that we most can benefit in doing as coaches is to be really familiar with our own story, whatever that story is, wellness, money, relationship, so that we can be an optimum catalyst to help the client develop his or her own story. So any additional things you'd like to add or ask before we officially start? I'll put us on mute when we get to the lecture portion so you don't have to worry about the management of background noise. But any comments or questions or anybody just want to say hi? I see some old buddies on the list and some people who are joining for the first time. So what you got? Questions, clarifications? Also, please manage the background noise, mute star six until you're ready to talk, because whatever you're doing, your microphone is picking up, even though you may not be hearing it. So any comments or questions or just check-ins from anyone? Things you want to add to those questions about what would you most like to ask as a primary question or what you really hope to get out of this series? Okay, guys, I'm getting a little lonely here. Anybody have any responses or clarifications about anything that you'd like to be sure we address? Or we can just move into the initial seminar, and I'll reserve a bit more time at the end for discussion. Let's do that, okay? I'm going to put us on mute so you don't have to worry about the background noise, but jot down any questions or comments you have, any clarifications first when we get to that segment. And I'll reserve at least 5, maybe 10 minutes at the end for discussion, because I'm interested in your input, your take, and primarily I'm going to ask what's the most important thing that you're hearing in this seminar that you're going to be taking away. So you know the question I'm going to get to. So hold on. Okay, welcome to the Art and Science of Coaching Wellness. In our first session, we're going to talk about the power of story and the concept of writing a new wellness story. This will parallel the introduction and the preface in your workbook. The following three sessions, we're going to develop and apply a philosophy and model of coaching wellness that can be used with individuals and groups anywhere in the world. And throughout, I'm going to speak about your wellness story. I want to encourage you, once again, to do the exercises and work pages to parallel our discussions. Then you'll know firsthand, I believe, in a better way, how to coach a new wellness story. Now, although we're going to discuss application to wellness, you'll see that the principles are fundamental to all growth, change, and transformation. First, why you? You are professionals who know how to listen and guide people. You are change experts and choice architects. You know that intentions need a strategy and a plan. You will learn a proven system of change and transformation, a macro system of strategy. The roadmap. The roadmap is the acronym for the 7 steps to create a new wellness story. It's a master plan to guide you to empowered wellness in your life story, including tools and exercises. Then you can coach it. First, broadly, what's the need for wellness coaching? You've seen what I believe are some compelling statistics in the workbook preface. Here's my belief. People don't need more advice about vitamins or told again to exercise or lose weight or stop smoking. They often don't do what they're told, even when they're paid to be told, when they pay to be told. For example, if you consult an expert, let's say you go to a physician, you're motivated by pain, maybe being scared, and you consult that expert, and the expert gives you an opinion, a recommendation of what to do. Let's say it's in the form of a prescription. how well is that really listened to and followed? Here's what we know. Less than 50% of people actually fill that prescription. Of those who fill it, slightly less than 50% take it as directed. So even when people are scared, in pain, consult an expert, pay to do so, less than 1 in 4 actually follow that advice. Now, I saw some excellent questions that orbit around how can we help someone change their mind. Here's what I'd recommend that you do. Look at my blog that's archived. I think it's the first or second, meaning it's one of the two most recent, on my website, MentorPath, and the top 4 tab is blog. That's a blog that I'm recommending right now. It's called How Can You Help Someone Change Their Mind? And that's essentially part of what we do in coaching. So, what's missing of those who only follow an expert's advice less than 1 in 4 times, or less than 1 in 4 follow the advice? They need to make it their own story, to own it. It's the physician's story. It's not their story. They're told what to do. What we know about when we're told what to do is it usually doesn't work. Here's a brief synopsis of what you'll see in that blog, especially since 2 or 3 of you ask almost this exact question. Whenever you offer an opinion, advice, belief, facts to someone, they have their own beliefs and ideas about what they're asking about. A belief as well as a fact is an anatomical reality in that person's brain. So immediately what they do is to see if what they hear fits with what they already believe, what's already in their brain. If it fits, they're going to find ways to agree with it, confirmation bias. They will seek ways to find affirmation. If they don't agree with it, they will seek ways to refute it. So what happens is they end up even more entrenched in their original position. Have you had that with a client when you've tried to give information or facts or slip in a little opinion camouflaged as a question? Well, have you thought about? So even this is a result. People who are brighter and more intellectually flexible end up even more entrenched in their original position because they find ways to more cleverly confirm or refute it. It's called the boomerang effect. You get exactly what the person already believes. So, people need a clear, specific, stepwise system for change and an informed guide to help them. They need an accountability partner who's an expert at change. Here's the principle we'll be talking about. If you want to change, don't just focus on the goal. Most people have the same goal, and goals are usually abstract. Focus on the system, on the stepwise system of creating a map. When you have a map, you know where you are, you know where you're going, you know how to measure progress along the way, and importantly, you know what's detour and distraction. That's the beauty of a map, all the stuff you don't pay attention to. That's the beauty of a focus at the beginning of a coaching session. All the stuff you're not, the millions of possibilities that you're not considering. So this is what we're expert at, is helping someone create a system so that they know when they hang up the phone from you, what's the first thing they need to do, and then what they need to do after what's next. So, the mission of wellness coaching is to help people establish healthier lifestyles to write their wellness stories, not for you to ghostwrite them, not for you to run in plays. So, in addition to individuals interested in health and longevity, who needs wellness coaching? The answer, any person, any organization, any business interested in achieving these goals, reducing medical claims and expenses, lowered stress, reducing absenteeism, improving morale, improving retention rates, generate overall savings of energy, of wellness, and of money. So what's then the scope of wellness coaching? Well, think about, if you're interested in moving into doing more wellness coaching, in addition to individual and group coaching, some of the portals of entry, the gatekeepers for wellness coaching, include human resource heads and groups, employee assistance programs, healthcare insurance companies, pharmaceutical companies, small business owners, school systems, government agencies, especially companies that are self-insured. Natural affiliates include fitness trainers and clubs, nutritionists, holistic care providers, healthcare providers, consortiums of wellness practitioners. So let's move to an application now. Why is change so difficult? In studies of coronary bypass patients, when their lives are at risk, unless they adopt healthier lifestyles, how many do you think actually change their habits? 1 in 9. It took Ignaz Semmelweis more than 20 years to persuade doctors that washing their hands would save the lives of mothers giving birth. He had the data, the proof, but it wasn't enough to change minds. He died, actually, before people came to believe and see what he saw as valid in order to change. Changing behavior is difficult. What keeps people from doing what they need to do for themselves? What is it that makes change so difficult, even when someone's life depends on it? A simple example. Data shows that driving while texting is more dangerous than driving while drunk. But how many people does that stop? Some of the resistance is staying in a comfort zone of the predictable and familiar. Another component of resistance is that our brains oppose change. They're programmed to operate on the default mode of question, of repetition. So keep this question in mind. Why is change so difficult? We're going to return to that and strategize about it. You have to own your wellness story. The light on the dashboard appears and says service engine now. If you disconnect so that the warning doesn't show, it may create an artificial sense of satisfaction. Another term, denial. Once you know something, you can really not ever not know it again. Denial is still a form of engagement, even though invisible above ground. People are afraid to go to the doctor. They aren't afraid of doctors. They're afraid their denial is going to be confronted. Making a physical symptom go away does the same thing. The symptom is the signal, a story in itself, a story needing and begging to be listened to and understood. Your body will simply find another way to bring you more information. If you listen to whispers, no one needs to shout. And just because you're not sick doesn't mean you're healthy. Now, in response to what one question, how do you define wellness? What is wellness? Let's start by saying wellness is a mindset. This mindset gives ownership of a life story of wellness to the individual. With this ownership comes the responsibility and privilege that each thought, feeling, experience, and behavior is created each moment. Think about that as a principle in your story, your wellness story. Whatever you think and feel and experience is what you create this moment. If you don't create it, it's not there. And to say that a different way, whatever you experience, you either accept or you create. Warren Buffett used the analogy of buying a car. If you get a new car every few years, the approach would be different than if you knew you were going to choose one car and have it for the rest of your life. You'd probably do research to know the best care for that car, probably change the oil more frequently, do everything possible for maintenance. knowing it would be the only car for the rest of your life, you'd take meticulous care of it. Your body is the only one you'll have for the rest of your life. Your body is irreplaceable. Everything about its care and maintenance matters. It reflects the cumulative care you take of it. Everything counts. After our seminar, take a look at the addendum on page 6 to see how two little French fries can weigh 40 pounds. Not now, but later, okay? Wellness integrates mind, body, and spirit with a balanced flow of energy. If you haven't already, I'd recommend you tag to read the Wellness System of Energy in the preface of the workbook, beginning on page little Roman numeral page 12. It introduces some later discussion on the impact of change on mind and brain. From the teachings of the Tao, the source of spiritual energy is physical, rooted in the base chemistry of the body. Self-cultivation refines this energy for spiritual attainment. Enlightenment is a psychophysiological achievement, a state of being rather than a physical understanding. Spirituality is an expression, a manifestation of energy. So let's look now at a new wellness story. We're in a revolution in the science of wellness and of aging. We understand how our bodies work at the cellular level. We understand healthy aging. We can live healthier lives than anyone in all of biological time. Now, this has taken a while because health is biologically way more complex than disease. Of 3,000 people surveyed, three activities stood out above all others as ones that prompted procrastination. Three areas people know exactly what to do, but yet often don't do it. Working out, a healthy diet, and the proper use of money. More than anything else, people put off exercise, eating a healthy, planned diet, and funding, for example, their retirement plan. What if you treated a task such as exercise with the same mindset as work? Or coach your client to do this. With work, you don't get up every day and debate about whether you will or won't work, whether you take off a couple of days or just skip it or take off and, well, I'll really get with it next Tuesday. Work is there. You get up, you go to work, you don't debate it. You don't consider it virtuous if you decide to go. In school, later in work, you show up. It's an organizing force, a deeply etched default mode. It's a part of your identity. If you go to work every day, whatever constitutes work, including full-time parenting, you don't use any energy about debating. I grew up on a farm and ranch. Every morning before school, I fed the cattle, same every evening. It was a given, no questions asked. Age 8 on, morning, evening, 7 days a week. Cattle had to eat. My dad helped me make it my story, and it stopped being work when some of them were my cattle. But I didn't really appreciate this until I was in an early morning class in college, my freshman year, and heard the people around me grinching about the early time and really putting energy into not wanting to be there. It never occurred to me to do that. And I was grateful at that point because I realized I never wasted any energy opposing something that I was going to do. Just like feeding the cattle, it was part of what I did. It became part of my identity. I got up and I did it. And I had much more energy for those early morning classes because there was nothing to oppose. There was nothing to complain about. Exercise can be the same mindset, the default story, but it needs a plan and a commitment, just like your business. That's why people need coaches. Biologically, your body only knows two things, growth or decay. Dr. Henry Lodge, in Younger Next Year, a perennial bestseller, says that 70% of aging is not aging, but decay. Blood vessels go to every millimeter of your body, and each bathes cells in repair or inflammation. Exercise heals wounded blood vessels. Lodge has devoted more than 35 years of his professional life as an internist in New York City to wellness and wellness research. And the companion book, also a bestseller, is called Younger Next Year for Women. I've sent both of these books to couples I've coached with. Here's a quote from Lodge in Younger Next Year. Steady exercise is a coded message to the body and your mind. In 20 years, failure to exercise 6 days a week will seem as self-destructive as smoking 2 packs of cigarettes a day. And he recommends this for everyone from age 40 on, definitely, unequivocally, age 50 on, 6 days a week, four of those being cardiovascular. We'll return to that. I promise you, you will not get away with only hearing that in that brief version from me. Recent research at the University of Vermont showed that even moderate physical activity improves mood up to 12 hours after the activity. Dr. Christian Werner in Hamburg summarized his institute's finding. Exercise at the molecular level has anti-aging effects. We're going to look at the process of change in an informed and a systematic way. First, I want to provide some context and maybe stimulus for you to actively work on the exercises and quizzes in the workbook for each of the 7 steps. The composite, the macro system, is the template, the roadmap system to guide and apply your wellness story. First, I want to look with you at the power of story. Why this as a metaphor? Write this question down. What is my story? When you can schedule even a brief appointment with yourself with no interference, come back to that question. Think about your story. It makes you who you are. Summarize your plot in one sentence. Bullet your major storylines, not your bio, your title, your role, your plot. I'll tell you mine. To live, love, contribute, and play with absolute passion. Then write this question. What is my wellness story? And again, here, consider making an appointment with yourself to brainstorm these 2 questions. So here are some premises that our work together will be based on. These are in your outline. 1, plot is the structure, purpose, and pattern of a story. For a life story, it's the outline of life narratives. The core assumptions of life stories involve what people look for and how they attribute meaning to what they experience. 2, we learn through stories. Stories are how we understand and how we remember. James Watson, the guy who discovered DNA with Crick, said, "You know, I can remember something when I fit it into a story." A story is a system for holding together facts. A story makes things make sense. Defense lawyers know this. Little kids standing next to broken vases know this. Miro Rukeyser said, "The world is made up of stories, not atoms." We personify the economy or the stock market as if each were a story of its own and had a mind of its own. Well, the market was a little resistant today. The market gave back some of its gains, grudgingly so. We make a story out of events in order to infer relationship and assign causality, or ascribe a story with a mind of its own to our own creations. My weight gets in the way. My anxiety stopped me. My ulcer acted up. Something we create in one way or another, we then see as that entity acting on us as if we're the victim rather than the author of it. Here's some very recent research that emphasizes this in a different way. that whenever we put something in an output channel, not just take in something passively, but use an output channel, such as when you ask your client at the end of the session, would you summarize in a brief way what you're taking away from this session? What does that do? It creates a closure in that circuitry of the brain. Here's a simple application. Recently, out of University of Waterloo, two matched groups read the same passage from a book. One group read it out loud. One group read it silently. The group, they then took a test. The group who read it out loud did 40% better on the test. Same amount of time, but they just put it in an output channel as they were doing it. Three, we each have a personal story with a plot and storylines. Our beliefs and our assumptions ghostwrite that story. From an infinite sea of possibilities, our software determines what we perceive and process. The brain needs a story. It will infer one. So it's helpful for us as coaches to know the lexicon, to know how stories are made, how brains and minds work, because we can be immensely more effective when we do something along the lines of how the mind and brain work instead of something that does not take that into account or even opposes it. Our plot consists of our core beliefs and assumptions that transform all available information into a system that makes sense. We then create life narratives according to plot, since mind and brain are both programmed to process by the default mode and to ignore facts that contradict our assumptions. That was what I was telling you, basically, that we seek out ways to agree with what we already believe and ways to refute what we don't believe. That's part of that active processing in terms of creating a story. Four, a life story contains silent assumptions and emotional scripts. Our assumptions tell us what to look for and how to perceive and process experiences. We have to believe in order to see. Some of our beliefs and patterns may be invisible even to ourselves. Here's an example of that. Gregory Maguire, a best-selling novelist and playwright, most recently the Broadway hit Wicked, said, "I didn't realize this at first, but there's almost no central character in any of my 24 books and plays who doesn't have a dead mother or a lost parent." Maguire's mother died from complications during his birth. After his 23rd book, he became conscious for the first time of that fact to say, you know, I can't seem to start a novel unless the character doesn't have a mother. If the mother's still alive, if the mother's still there, what's the problem? There's nothing to write about. He became aware of self-statements. We're hearing in the news now that even the intelligence departments of our government have figured out that when Russia claims the enemy is doing something, they know where to look for what's next. And that's the speaker. That's the self-statement of the speaker. Six, we don't see things as they are. I skipped over five. That's in your outline. We believe and remember only that which fits our plot. That fits in with what we're saying. What we expect to happen in the present reveals instantly our experience in the past. Psychoanalysts call this transference. Someone abandoned early in life will expect more of the same in future relationships, even though circumstances change. All subsequent information is absorbed, filtered, and organized by that narrative plot. The patterns of attachment, emotional patterns, relationship patterns, those kinds of patterns get repeated when they get repeated with you in the process of the relationship with your client. You have immediate access. You will never, in coaching, you will never have to go back into the past or dig deep or go into why questions. Every algorithm that's important will appear as thought, feeling, behavior in the process with you, and you'll have direct access to it. The algorithms that are important will manifest in the process of the relationship with you, and you'll have direct access. And we'll come back to how to work with that in coaching, especially as it applies to wellness at a later point. Six, we don't see things as they are. We see things as we are. We see what we believe, and we're always right because we write the story. Here's an illustration. This is out of England. A few years back, two anthropologists were chosen to enter separate, essentially identical ape colonies to live and observe for a year. They had remarkable similarities and were chosen because of the similarities, personality, philosophy, training, education. They each entered their ape colonies, did not communicate with anyone else, but just were immersed for a year. When they emerged to compare notes, they and their research teams expected essential similarities, but instead found really remarkable discrepancies. One anthropologist, after an initial period of transition, was accepted by the apes. He was integrated into the colony, achieved a unity and comfort with the apes, a real sense of emotional and social connection. The other anthropologist never got beyond the social periphery of his colony. He remained careful and vigilant, always seemed right on the cusp of a conflict, never achieved that comfort or harmony. The two anthropologists and their teams did not understand these discrepant results. They couldn't find any reason. They puzzled for months until they finally found one difference. The anthropologist, who was the uncomfortable, careful outsider, had a gun. Now, his gun never showed. He never used it. The apes never knew he had it, but he knew he had it. He knew that if things got tough, he had an out. The anthropologist who had no gun had a belief and a commitment. He knew from the beginning he would either make it or not on his own. And in retrospect and reconstruction, each of their assumptions created the reality that they experienced. We tell our story, then our story tells us. Seven, a story can define possibility. You guys know this story. In centuries of recorded time, no one ran the mile in under 4 minutes. It was impossible, physiologically impossible, as declared by scientists and the medical community. Dr. Roger Bannister broke the 4 minute mile in 1954. Within the following 18 months, 12 other runners broke the 4 minute mile as well, and now it's commonplace for high school milers to break that mark. The obstacle of the impossible could no longer be constructed. When the mindset of what's possible changes, reality then changes as well. And remember my earlier sentence, wellness is a mindset. Eight, a story can define reality. A placebo generates the effect of the accompanying story. A patient is prescribed an inert pill and some expectations. A story, in other words. In the overwhelming majority of cases, it's the story that becomes the reality. By anticipating an experience, we can create it. The story generates a truth so powerful that it can even reverse the pharmacological effect of a real medicine. So whether it's an inert placebo or an actual medication, that the story is it's going to act in the opposite way, like the placebo. It's a white lie, a fiction that becomes a truth. In fact, a recent MIT study showed that a more expensive placebo worked significantly better than a much cheaper one. Same placebo, different stories. Now, this isn't about being gullible or suggestible. For example, when a patient believes something will reduce pain, the body releases endorphins. Medical research suggests that over 70% of successful non-surgical treatments are the result of the patient's belief that the treatment will work. And of course, that is predicated on the physician's belief that the treatment will work and how this is conveyed to the patient. 9, a story can take over the author. Listen to these expressions. My anger took over. My fear stopped me. Here are some ways we can see ourselves, as I mentioned, as the victims of stories that we create rather than the author. My work eroded my free time. My weight gets in the way. My doubt paralyzed me. We ascribe a story with a mind of its own to our own creation and forget that we're the author of that story. It's not there until we create it. It's a blank page. Another example of the power of story is a woman I know, a former client of mine, who recalled an incident from her adolescence. She attended a Catholic all-girls boarding school. She said, at one party, I started a rumor that the punch was spiked and everybody got drunk. 10, your life is the self-statement, the manifestation of what exists inside you. This is back to what we were talking about self-statement. What people say and do are inevitable, unavoidable self-statements of their beliefs and personal realities. All that you say and do is about yourself. What you say about me tells me about you. Everyone is always making self-statements, so don't take it personally. Look at the glossary of the workbook. There are some definitions I put back there, mostly so I could just share some of the best quotes from my collection. But there is a definition and an illustration about self-statement there. You define yourself. Other people's definitions of you are more about themselves, to make them feel better, what they want or don't want to own, or what they want to disavow or project onto you. 11, when you change the way you look at things, the things you look at change. Neuroscience shows that pure facts are a myth. Quantum physics seconds the motion. This observation came originally from quantum physics and the process of observing quarks. And 12, listen very carefully to this. An authentic belief in someone activates their brain to create a state of mind that transcends usual thinking and performance. That's why I believe it's important for me, at least, to only work with people in whom I believe. An authentic belief in someone activates their brain that can create a state of mind to transcend their usual thinking and performance. They live into your belief of them. And that doesn't mean you start orchestrating or justified in giving advice or anything like that. So lose all of that right now. This one comes from neuroscience, even though good parents have known it for centuries, that you believe in your child until your child believes in herself or himself. So let's return to the question about difficulty of change. Why do we resist change, even changing a story that doesn't work? What keeps people from doing what they know to do and need to do for themselves? Why will someone repeat behavior that doesn't work, often do it harder, and expect a different result, even when they see it leads to lower energy or debt or plateaued career or disappointing relationships? Nassim Taleb asked in The Black Swan, what are our minds made for? It looks like we have the wrong user's manual. Now, there's a two-part answer. Part of the answer to why we resist change is in our minds. We repeat the same story because it's our comfort zone. It's secure and predictable. It may be limiting or uncomfortable, but it's familiar. It's the default mode. We know how it's going to turn out, and that can create the illusion of effectiveness to have predictability. A new story generates uncertainty, trepidation, and the easiest and fastest way to end this discomfort is to stop and go back to the familiar, the old story. People fail to change because they don't feel safe changing. Changing means leaving their home base of reality, the internal map that's synonymous with identity, as well as the comfort of knowing exactly how it's going to turn out. Let's do a brief exercise. Put your palms together in front of you and firmly interlock your fingers. With your hands firmly clasped, notice which thumb is on top. Now, keep your fingers exactly the same, but change your thumbs so the other one's on top. How's that feel? A little bit goofy, kind of awkward? Now, put your hands back in the original position, your thumb where it belongs. That's why people don't change. They return to their comfort zone. Now, up the ante, add significant success or significant stress, such as major transition, really out of a comfort zone. We'll talk later about comfort zones and how to program change, because there's always the pull of the old and the fear of the new. Always that dialectic. Now, a comfort zone is a familiar pattern of behavior. It's gradual, but once established, it resists change. It's like a home thermostat. If the temperature increases or decreases, even a degree or two, it signals an adjustment to return to the set point. Our minds and brains both contribute. We have a comfort zone with our weight. Even though we're not comfortable, perhaps, or want to change, it's still that default mode. We return to the familiar even when we don't like it or when it's uncomfortable. And it's hard to leave it and to stay gone from that comfort zone. A comfort zone is predictable and automatic. We know the outcome. Think about how subtle a comfort zone, which is really establishing an ongoing pattern of relationship that becomes hardwired, what you eat, the difficulty of starting a new exercise program. Remember, a habit is not a definition. It's not an identity. It's simply a choice that gets repeated. Now, the other part of that answer to why change is difficult is in our brains. The hypnotist Milton Erickson told a story from his childhood in which, whenever it snowed, he would be the first to get up and go to school so that he would create a fresh path in the snow. He intentionally created a circuitous path with zigzags and indirect turns. He noticed that each person who followed him followed the same path. Until the end of the day, the path was well-worn, despite it really being circuitous. No one, not one person, started a new, more direct route. No matter how many turns and twists, each person in turn followed the path of least resistance. And he repeated this a number of times, always with the same result. This is how neural pathways are laid down in the brain by early experiences, then repeated until they're etched more deeply, even if they don't work as well, even if they're circuitous, take more time and energy. Discomfort and uncertainty begin any significant journey, every step of change. Our brains even have an error detection mechanism located very close to the emotional center that says, this isn't normal when we try something new. We're going to come back to that and talk about how to use this mechanism as part of a powerful internal navigation system. Now, listen for the power of story. Your brain can rewire. New experiences done consistently form new neuronal pathways and new neural networks. And some remarkable new research shows both beliefs as well as repeating new experiences can both alter gene expression. When we write a new story and change our minds, we change our brains. Metaphors and narratives become brain structures. Also from the Black Swan, ideas come and go, stories stay. Here's a study of active choice, I believe an excellent example, even though it wasn't intended to be initially by the research group, of choice architecture. I'd like to describe it and have you guess the biggest change impact. Now, I know a handful of you have heard me do this before. But remember, you're on mute, so it won't do any good to give any clues to anybody. Ben Fletcher at the University of Hertfordshire in the UK devised a study to get people to break their usual habits. Each day, the subjects chose a different option from poles of contrasting behaviors, lively, quiet, introvert, extrovert, reactive, proactive, talk about business, talk about sports. They would choose, and they behaved according to what they chose. So an introverted person would act like an extrovert for the entire day. Additionally, twice weekly, they stretched to behave in a way outside their usual pattern. The research team had them eat something twice a week they would never have eaten before, and read something twice a week they would never have read before. So, after 4 months, what do you think the biggest change in this group was? The remarkable finding that actually baffled the research team was that after 4 months, the subjects lost an average of 11 pounds. 6 months later, almost all kept the weight off. This wasn't a diet, but it was a study focusing on change and its impact. So when they studied more closely, what actually happened? The rationale was that requiring people to change routine behavior made them actually think about decisions rather than habitually choosing a default mode without even thinking about it. They came to ask themselves, for example, is this in my best interest? Many came to even ask that about every bite they took. Is this bite in my best interest? Think about how that's the antithesis of how we usually eat. We sit down, take a couple of bites, and then we kind of zone out. We're into conversation or thought. We're not thinking about, is this bite in my best interest? So average lost 11 pounds, continued to lose weight for up to a year when the study stopped. Once becoming aware of actively making choices, you can decide what's in your best interest, what furthers your story, and what doesn't. Think about that's our specialty in professional coaching, choice architecture. And that's what we help our clients develop, the self-reflection and observation to be able to do. So here are some principles to close. And I'm interested in any clarification or questions you have or what you're hearing of value from this. Here are some principles that focus on facilitating change. This is the preface, in my view, to writing a new wellness story. One, each person's life story is created. In adulthood, you create whatever you think and experience and feel each moment. Every day is a blank page until you begin writing on, until you create what you think and feel and experience. Even though it may seem to the individual to just be the way things are just happening. Two, knowing what not to do is at least as important as knowing what to do. You may not always know what the next right thing is, but you can almost know always what it isn't. And Sandra, that's the cheesecake with the strawberry topping for after this seminar is over. That's just my bet. Three, when people create their own answers, they've signed on to invest in the outcome. This establishes the beginning of a sense of effectiveness and mastery. When they choose the focus and the destination, they take ownership of that story that guides the conversation that you have with that client for that session. The antithesis, somebody tells what to do, gives you suggestions or a multiple choice, and we're going to talk in a later session how the brain lights up with an aha or inside experience in three different parts. When advice, information, facts, orders, directives are given, no part of the brain lights up. Four, change is constant and inevitable. It's the resistance to change that generates most problems. Small changes lead to big changes. Issues that can seem overwhelmingly large and insurmountable can be approached by looking at the simplicity in order to specify progress, to shrink the change, to create a map, to know what the next step is. When your client hangs up the telephone from talking to you in the coaching session, do they know specifically what to do next and what to do after what's next? If they have a goal, you know, generate more income, that doesn't tell you what to do next. Six, problems, causes, and solutions are not always related or even interconnected. And correlation is not the same as causality. To resolve a problem, even emotionally, to come to the end of the past, does not create a blueprint for success. That's why there are a lot of frustrated therapy refugees. Strategic plans for strategic and specific goals are necessary. If something's a totally new experience, you may need a guide, even for something like a healthier diet or exercise. I'm not suggesting you're the guide as that coach, but you're the guide for the story and the co-collaborator and creator. 7, the benefit of doing more of what's working and less of what's not will become evident and self-perpetuating. I mean, that's the basic tenet of professional coaching. If it works, do more of it. If it doesn't work, do something else. 8, you need to know where you're going, goals and strategies. This is where a map comes into play. Lewis Carroll said it really well. Alice came to a fork in the road. "Which road do I take?" she asked. "Where do you want to go?" asked the Cheshire Cat. "I don't know," Alice answered. Then said the cat, "It doesn't matter." 9, you need the correct paradigm. You need the map that will get you from where you are to where you want to be. And the paradigm often includes a mindset and includes a system. We're going to talk about that in more detail. An example here is you need to be afraid of the right thing. You know, for example, smokers who are afraid of flying. Average across all participants, smoking shortens their lives by 5 years. Average across all participants, flying shortens their lives by 1 day. People may be afraid of somebody entering their homes and committing a violent crime more than food entering their bodies that clog arteries and cause heart attacks. And 10, decide what you want, believe it's possible. A belief is a filter between reality and our perception. A belief is the mind's command to the brain, the software that drives behavior. We now know that beliefs can actually turn genes on or turn them off. You can change your life by changing your beliefs. Our possibilities are determined by the ones we allow ourselves to see and to create. We're now in conversation mode, if you'll manage the background noise. I'm interested, what's the most important thing you're taking away from this seminar? I'm eager to hear what has the most impact and meaning for you and your coaching or your story.
I don't know if you can hear me, Dr. Kruger, but...
I can. I'll talk to you if you call me Dave and tell me your name.
Okay.
Or your first
Dave.
Name, at least.
I'm Tina Murky.
So,
and
go ahead.
And I'm and I think one of the reasons I ended up in pathology instead of psychiatry and surgery was because I felt frustrated by the number of patients who didn't want to take any part in their own change, you know, who only wanted advice from the physician and then, to your point, generally wouldn't follow it. And I found the patients I wanted to deal with were people that wanted to help themselves, you know, had skin in the game. And
may I interrupt you to ask you a question? Would you put in one sentence what you found most successful to get someone engaged in that process of collaboration with you in one sentence?
And in one sentence, what I was getting to was the fact that you need to have their story, that we need to find out, I need to find out their story
exactly.
To help them create the change they need.
Because otherwise you wouldn't know what's not working or why it's not working. Your point is excellent, and that's a huge takeaway. In working, let me give you a more vivid example, at least as vivid as physicians giving advice. I work with pro coaches. Now, they know for every position on that field what each professional player needs to do. When they tell them what to do, it won't work any more than someone giving advice, even though they're paid to do it, and it might increase their performance. So the key here is exactly what we do in professional coaching. Instead of giving advice, information, facts, ask a question. When you begin by asking a question, there's nothing to oppose. There's nothing to fit into whether you believe it or not, even unconsciously. It engages the person to begin to think with you, so you've moved it in one sentence to a collaborative model, which is exactly what we do and how we operate in coaching, is a collaborative framework that we together will focus on understanding and developing the client story according to their needs and their ideals. Super point, and I appreciate that very much. Who else? What are you taking away in one sentence? That's the challenge, to do it in one sentence. I need a volunteer. I'm interested in... Go ahead.
Hi, it's Olga Widner speaking.
Super, go ahead.
So in one sentence, what I'm taking away from this session is that decide what you want and believe you can have it. That's amazing.
Okay.
So that's, I think, is like, yeah, very motivational.
And we tend to live out what we believe because it determines our focus and how we organize and perceive things. Each state of mind is like a software program. It determines input, and then once input, the processing and the action or the behavior. So that's why it's important to know and important to determine early on, and it's something that we actively collaborate to come to know, as Tina mentioned, the story of the client, and to ask powerful questions to get the client to actively look at becoming more subjectively and objectively aware of their own experience, which is the legacy that we leave, because this model of doing that and of creating a map, a system to pursue what they want to pursue and doing it effectively and consistently, that's what they'll take with us and why we ultimately will not be needed by that client, because they've downloaded the model that we've operated on collaboratively and are doing that themselves now. They've developed their own empathy, their own ability to develop their system. So thanks very much. Great, great point. Who else? I'm sorry, I didn't hear either. The one of you to the left. Go ahead. Just take it and we'll come back to...
Sorry.
Go ahead. No,
this
you
is
go
Laura.
Ahead. Yeah.
My one sentence is going to be that we are each our own best, worst saboteurs.
Okay. How would you reframe that positively as a challenge and a positive framework to engage possibility and excitement in one sentence?
We have more power to determine our wellness than we think.
Perfect. Yes, that's a great way to do it. And think about, that's what we usually do in coaching. To back into that, our brain doesn't know the difference between excitement and anxiety. If we interpret something as anxiety, then it makes sense to head for cover, to stop. And it immediately treats the anxiety, so it validates that we were right. If, however, you interpret that excitement as challenge, as opportunity, and proceed, then you look at activating new neuronal networks and connections in the brain and at going a very different direction to look at opportunity and optimizing what you do. That's exactly what we do in coaching, is to help someone frame something in a way that they can benefit. They begin to talk about a problem, and that's why I ask every client, as you've already heard me do, if I may interrupt them at any point, if there's something that I believe it would be helpful for us to look at that moment. If they begin to elaborate about a problem, they've got that problem down. They know every way from Sunday how that goes. So I'll interrupt and say, what's the management of background noise, please? What's the opportunity here, or what's the challenge or possibility, to have them reframe it and to think of it in possibility terms? I know we're over, but I want to mention one study from a whole body of work that I think is useful in coaching, and I don't hear it incorporated nearly enough. The whole area of appreciative inquiry. I had the founder of that group as a guest of mine in the mastermind group. Dr. David Copperwriter did studies in a number of organizations to frame things in one of two ways, to to look at problems, and when he asked about problems, he had the usual consultancy conversation. People looked at problems, solutions, brainstorm. When he asked about possibilities, there was a significantly different mindset and success rate of dealing with things in a new and different way, of creatively engaging different aspects that never had before begun to be considered. That's exactly what we do in coaching. That's why we focus on possibility, on looking at co-creating a new way of proceeding rather than going into a problem or asking about problems. Thank you all very much. Those of you who haven't yet sent in answers to those, I'm very interested in what you think. I really appreciate those of you who have sent in, and I appreciate the discussion and the points that you've made in an excellent way, and that was a catalyst for something I hope will be helpful. We'll do more of that, and we'll have more discussion beginning and end, as well as in the middle. So thanks very much. Take good care of yourselves, and I look forward to picking up right here next time. Look at the outline and look at some of the exercises about what we will be talking about. It may have an impact of having even more meaning and application for you. Thanks very much. I'm excited about our collaboration. See you guys.
Thank you, Dave.
Thank you.
Absolutely.
Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye.
Thank you.